Yeah, it's really a change of outlook, I think. It's about moving away from this siloed approach to information to opening it up to a broader number of people within foreign ministries and across agencies.
Diplomats are normally seen as discreet, secretive hoarders rather than sharers of information. Does this go against the natural instinct of many diplomats?
I think in different countries there's been a very different reaction. So if you look at Australia, for example, there's been a real battle just to get a single Twitter feed opened up. There hasn't really been many tools developed internally to facilitate knowledge exchange within DFAT. But if you can contrast that with the United States, it's a completely different story. So I went along, for example, to what was called a tweetorial to teach diplomats how to use Twitter and best practice. And there was about 50 people in the room, and it was run by a very junior lady at the State Department who basically told everyone to get on Twitter. You can't really go wrong. So I think there's a really different cultural approach there.
You're seeing a resistance even within the State Department, though, from some of the older diplomats to being told to get on Twitter?
Yeah, certainly. I mean, it's not across the board by any means, but I think what's happened at State has been a very strong top-down directive from Hillary Clinton, the Secretary of State, that she wouldn't just like this to happen, she expects it to happen. Diplomats are being told in pretty uncertain terms that they need to innovate, that they need to get online, and they need to start communicating and listening to people. And by and large, that is happening. State now has about 600 social media platforms. It's communicating directly with about 8 million people. So it really is getting out there, in at least in the public diplomacy sphere, but also internally there's been a lot of internal innovations.
Why is Hillary Clinton so keen on e-diplomacy? What's the advantage?
The big advantage is that it's modernising the department to bring it into the 21st century. State is the oldest federal agency in the United States. It has a lot of traditional ways of doing things, and the foreign ministries around the world are stuck in a sort of pattern of doing things while the rest of the world is moving on. I think that she's experienced personally the power of social media in the 2008 presidential elections, and has a strong appreciation, I think, of just how useful these new technologies can be, both in terms of saving money, doing things more efficiently, doing them better, but also, I think, an appreciation that the world is changing and that the state needs to change with it.
Your report finds that the US has developed its e-diplomacy far more than any other country, and that this has changed the way that it conducts its foreign policy. Can you give some specific examples of how the US foreign policy has been changed by this?
Well, I think in the most obvious way that this has changed has been in terms of public diplomacy. So whereas the State Department used to conduct public diplomacy activities through speeches and little seminars and contacts with, you know, hundreds, tens of people, now it communicates directly with millions of people every day through social media. And just to put that in perspective, I mean, that's a larger audience than the subscriber base of the 10 largest newspapers in the United States combined. So one of the things I suppose about social media is that people around the world generally are moving onto these platforms, and if you want to maintain contact with your audience, then it makes sense to be communicating with them on their preferred platforms. Another thing, I suppose, is that in some cases there can be very serious nation branding crises, like the Indian student attacks in Australia, where Australia's reputation in India suffered enormously and it had enormous consequences for Australia's economy. DFAT wasn't positioned to be able to respond to that situation and that online commentary, whereas I think the State Department is much better suited for responding to a situation like that.
Why is there a fear of e-diplomacy in Australia?
I think it really comes down to a cultural perception that somehow these tools are dangerous or risky. There's probably also a lack of familiarity amongst more senior members, perhaps, of how to use these tools. But I think largely that sort of perception is misleading, or the risks are imaginary. When you look at states' experience, for example, you'd be very hard pressed to find an example where this had caused an enormous controversy. So I think that sort of perception that these tools are risky is misplaced. Because there are enormous incentives for staff to behave responsibly when they use these, number one being that they want to keep their jobs.
How did the WikiLeaks cable drop last year, where so much of what had been private communication became public, shift the views in the US State Department about e-diplomacy? Did it make people more or less wary about changing to a more open culture?
Well, I think the drive for innovation has pressed on ahead. I don't think that there's been any impact in terms of use of Twitter and social media. I mean, realistically, any staff member can get on Twitter or Facebook in their private capacity. They can print off a secret cable and hand it out to anyone they want. Of course, they'll be fired for doing it. But the same incentives apply, you know, with or without WikiLeaks. They can still leak government documents if they want to, and there's consequences for doing that. But 99.9% of diplomats everywhere want to keep their job and are working to support the national interest, so they're not going to do that.
I find it intriguing that a lot of the technology that you say in your report is being used in various areas of the State Department is in fact free off the web. The whole notion that the US State Department is using shareware for its diplomacy, I mean, are we seeing a fundamental shift away from the whole culture of secrecy in diplomacy?
Yeah, well, I think one of the issues that really drove the use of free tools was the fact that they were so constrained in budgetary terms, somewhat like DFAT. There was, when the office was first set up, they had very limited resources, and so the obvious thing to look at was free tools. These free tools also happen to be some of the best that are available and tend in many cases to be better than proprietary tools anyway. So even when the office has been better resourced, there's been a definite urge to try and use free tools wherever they're available.
So a parliamentary inquiry is now underway in Australia into the Department of Foreign Affairs' use of social media. Do you expect that it will lead to any significant change in Australia?
Well, I think it's really good that the parliamentary inquiry is looking at this issue. I think it's the second time that they have, in fact, taken up e-diplomacy as something that DFAT should be looking at. I think one of the biggest requirements will be for the new foreign minister, if they do want to do something in e-diplomacy, I think it'll be necessary for the new foreign minister to really push for that. We've seen the example in the United States where it took where three successive secretaries of state have been advocating quite forcefully for e-diplomacy and for new innovation. So I think it really takes a mandate from the top to achieve success in this area.
Do you think Bob Carr is an enthusiast?
Well, I think he's a perfect person for it, actually, because he's not. He uses Twitter. He has a blog, and I think. But I think he's also not naive or overly optimistic about e-diplomacy tools. You need to have some perspective on these, I think, and I think he's got that. He's the same age as Hillary Clinton, who has been a real driver of these tools and this innovation drive at state. So, and he has an appreciation for the United States, so I think he'd be a perfect person to try and push forward these tools and give him a legacy at DFAT.
If you were advising him, what would be your most compelling argument about why Australia should embrace e-diplomacy? What would change for the better?
Well, I think the number one thing is that DFAT faces budgetary constraints, and this is a chance to do things better, more efficiently and at less cost. DFAT has some of the toughest entry requirements for staff, and it, as a result, recruits some of the most intelligent people in the public service. But at the moment, their capacity is not being harnessed, and the innovation that is just sort of sitting there latent is not being used. And I think if you look at what's happened at the State Department, there's enormous talent there and enormous opportunity. And there's no reason I can see that why DFAT wouldn't have the same talent there to help Australia achieve diplomatic outcomes through technology.
Fergus Hanson, thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks very much, Eleanor.
Thank you. I look forward to the next instalment.
Appreciate it.
Okay then. Bye-bye.
Okay. Bye.